Our text is 1 Kings 18, verses 1 to 16. We are in the life of Elijah, and we are moving toward this contest on Carmel. The Lord willing, I think we will get there next Sunday night. But the 16 verses tonight will just simply get us all ready for that confrontation that is going to happen big time between Elijah, King Ahab on the one side, the Lord God, and the prophets of Baal on the other side. That is a very momentous occasion, and we'll get there next Sunday night, the Lord willing, and the creeks don't rise. I don't think that there is another Super Bowl or anything quite like that to break up our flow of things, so we will do that next Sunday night. But first, allow me to read 1 Kings 18, 1 through 16. This is it's kind of an interesting, though little known, it seems to me, part of the life of Elijah. 1 Kings 18, 1, it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, that is, I take it the third year of the drought, in the third year, saying, "Go, present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth." So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria. And Ahab had called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. And this is where we begin to kind of go on a little apparent rabbit trail. We start learning about this gentleman named Obadiah. And as you read about him, you begin to think, now wait a minute, this guy is really the polar opposite of Elijah. And so these 16 verses become kind of a study in the different kind of people that God uses to get his work done. And that's where I want to go with this tonight. I read about this and I think, wow, this is a study in contrasts. And I just want to say more about that, but I got to finish reading. So here we go. Again, verse 3. Again, Ahab had called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. For so it was, while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them, 50 to a cave, and he had fed them with bread and water. So this is the gentleman now we bang into. Ahab had said to Obadiah, "Go into the land, to all of the springs of water and to all of the brooks. Perhaps we may find grass to keep the horses and the mules alive, so that we will not have to kill any livestock." So they divided the land between them to explore it. Ahab went one way by himself. Obadiah went another way by himself. Now as Obadiah was on his way, suddenly Elijah met him. And he recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is that you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your master, Elijah is here." So he said, "How have I sinned that you are delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to hunt for you." And when they said, "He's not here," Ahab took an oath from that kingdom or nation that they could not find you. And now you say, "Go tell your master Elijah is here." And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from you, that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to a place I do not know. So when I go and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me. I don't know if that's sanctified imagination or just imagination, but you can understand something of this man's personality and the way he approached life, or perhaps just to put it straight out, the fear. he was a very fearful person, was he not? To a degree. And especially when you contrast him with Elijah, who at least up to this point in our story seems to be afraid of nothing and no one. Okay, on we go. I'm at the end of verse 12, I think. But I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Was it not reported to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your master Elijah is here. He will kill me. Then Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely present myself to him today. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. That will be quite a confrontation when those two strong men finally step into each other's presence after three and a half years of drought. But in the meantime, I need to talk to you about these two men and think out loud about Obadiah, a rather fearful, tentative kind of a guy, and Elijah, who seems to be much more of a fearless and confrontational kind of a guy. Now, in order to get at this, I have to, or at least I'm going to, let you in on the life of a state representative for a few moments, if you will. You know that I have worked with the churches of Ohio, the regular Baptist churches, for over, 18 years. And before that, even as a instructor at Cedarville, I was out as a as an interim pastor and worked with churches looking for pastors. So I've been inducted into that kind of thinking a long time. And when I read this passage and thought about the contrast between these two people, it just reminded me of some things, some lessons that came to me as particularly a representative of the churches. When I left teaching to go out there among the churches, I do remember one of my faculty colleagues saying to me, I'd like to give you my condolences. And he said, he followed up with, you know, you've been working with college students who are very impressionable and plastic, and you can have a real impact on that kind of person. But you are going out to work now with these Baptist pastors, and they are not so plastic. As a matter of fact, they are more like set in concrete. And you are going to, you know, he was basically saying to me, you're crazy. Why in the world would you want to do something like that? And I just essentially said, thank you very much. Pray for me. It's too late. I've already done this. I've already made my decision. So I'm just kind of reflecting on all of that. I hope you won't be too upset with me if I'm very personal with you for a little bit tonight. The first thing that I learned in all of that process of getting out there, the very first thing I learned was simply that God has his people. God has his people. I remember in the very early months of that task, my mailbox would be filled every day. And it was filled essentially with resumes of people who were looking to become pastors in the state of Ohio. I never lacked for a resume in 18 years. That paper trail, and then it turned into an electronic trail by email, that trail of resumes never ran dry like the Brook Cherith did on Elijah. I learned in that sense that God has his people. There are men out there, and I'm limiting it to my own experience here. There are men who are available, men who are looking, men who want to serve the Lord in the churches. Now, I also learned that Ohio was a very popular state. I didn't quite realize that. Ohio is a wonderful place to be. It really is. I love Ohio. Even though I was born in Michigan, and some of you have held that against me, I know, all of these days. But I really prefer the state of Ohio. But so do a whole lot of other people. And there are a lot of people in Ohio. And so I found out that a lot of folks want to get into Ohio because they have family in Ohio. Or they have family somewhere scattered around Ohio, and if they could land in Ohio, it would be a lot quicker to get to their family. And I also found that the Lord didn't mind that. It was okay. It may not have been the principal motivation, but it was a motivation, and the Lord seemed to honor that. I worked with over 150 churches in all of that time, and the largest number was of pastorless churches was 17. And then the lowest number of pastorless churches during that time was 3. When I was done, three months ago or so, it was again down to 3 churches that were searching. But I'm happy to tell you that I never had to answer a call for resumes and names and people that I could suggest with an, "I'm sorry, I'm out of resumes, I don't have any." Never had that problem. And I learned God has his people. Now, to be honest about it, sometimes it looked pretty bleak. Not necessarily in terms of the number of resumes or available people I could suggest, but more because of the condition of the local churches. There have been many a time when I have met with a group of people in a local church and walked away from that meeting or driven away from that meeting and just shaking my head saying, "Lord, how are you ever going to find somebody for that group?" I'm thinking of one up in Northeast Ohio. I probably shouldn't be too specific. You may have people who are there. But I'm thinking of one up in Northeast Ohio. The church had dwindled down to such a small number that when I met with their search committee, I was meeting with the entire church. It was kind of a committee of the whole. And they had their tales of woe, etc. And of course, as you might guess, when you have that few people and an older building and an older congregation, there's not going to be any money. There's no way. How can you support someone? And I remember driving particularly away from that one. And I said to Pat, who was with me, I said, "Boy, I just don't know who I could even suggest to go there." And it was interesting, because what I'm getting at here is this. It didn't matter how many resumes I had on the file back home. There were people who were available of whom I knew nothing. They were available beyond my pale of resumes. And I still remember that church. They found a gentleman who lived within about 25 miles. He was a retired person, a retired missionary, actually. He didn't need a whole lot of money to support. He had, other means of support, so he didn't need a whole lot of money. And I remember the invitation that I got. It was about a year later. They said, "We want you to come and be here for our 80th anniversary as a church." And Pat and I arrived. There was hardly room to sit. The place was jammed. And there was enthusiasm and there was energy. And There was a Sunday morning service, and then you had this meal afterward out in the grounds. And I drove away from that just obviously thrilled and probably a little bit rebuked. And to think, my goodness, God has his people. That's true in this story. God had his Elijah. I'll say a little bit more about the contrast here. But Elijah was given a particular task and a particular personality, a particular bent of mind, if you will. And only an Elijah could have done what he did. By the same vein, Obadiah was given a task as well. And only an Obadiah with the particular personality and bent of mind that he had could have done what he did. And that's what I mean when I say God has his people. As I rubbed shoulders with all of those folks all of those years across the state of Ohio and beyond, I began to realize, and this was kind of forced, kind of forced upon me, really, that God loves variety, and that he actually uses people who are quite different, the one from the other. There's hope. There's actually hope for every one of us that God could use us in some unique and wonderful way in his service, given who we are and what he has made us to be, rather than just writing ourselves off and say, oh, I could never, or he could never use me, etc., etc. No, these two men who stand in such sharp and striking contrast illustrate that God has his people. He does. I'm thinking of another situation, the one I described in Northeast Ohio, really was probably 17 years ago. The one that I'm about to describe was about 2 years ago. Over in Eastern Ohio, just a small town, a church that was formerly in the American Baptist Convention left that and joined our fellowship here in Ohio, the OARBC. And a very much more recent story, really. I was on vacation in Florida. By the way, Dan asked us, what are we doing here? Why aren't we all in Florida? Well, nobody answered. I was going to say, well, we're here because we don't have any dough. You know, we don't have the money to get down there. But we do have our health here. We're not in a tornado or some other thing. Where was I? Anyway, I was on vacation in Florida about 2 years ago, something like that. And I got a call from one of the deacons of the church there. And it was a bad situation. The pastor, incidentally, as a sidelight, the pastor had led them into our fellowship of churches. He had been a regular Baptist person in his background. So when he became the pastor there, ultimately, he led the church into our fellowship, which was a good thing, I thought. The bad thing was then that he turned around and had a moral failure. And I thought, oh boy, they're done with us, you know, and I wouldn't have blamed them if they were. But that wasn't why the deacon was calling me. I was at Disney World, of all places, with our grandchildren, and I had to go find a fairly quiet place to talk to them. But I knew it was some kind of a real emergency if they're calling me on vacation in Florida over Christmas. Well, what had happened was they had an interim pastor who wanted to become the pastor. And the people didn't want him to become the pastor, but the deacons did. And so finally, the entire deacon board resigned and walked out. So they had no pastor. They had no interim pastor. They had no deacons. And the only thing they had left were the board of trustees. And the trustees had been fighting with the deacons all along anyway. So it was not a happy So you can understand where I'm going with this. It's like, Lord, do you have somebody? do you have somebody that could step in and kind of put this all together? And you know, he did. God had a man who was in the community. I didn't know him from a bale of hay. I didn't even know he existed. But some in the congregation knew him, and he had some history with them from prior days. And so he served as their interim. And now today, they have another full-time senior pastor, a board of deacons, and they're happily in our fellowship. And it's kind of like, wow, only the Lord could do this. And that was one of the lessons I had to learn as a representative. And I think as illustrated in this text, and that's the important thing, that God has his own. God has his people. And he uses all kinds of folks. And that's really the second point that I would like to make. Not only that God has his people, but secondly, his people often differ dramatically from each other. His people differ dramatically from one another. I've already alluded to this. I'll try to develop it just a little bit. Obadiah, obviously a godly person. As a matter of fact, he says, I have been a God-fearer from my youth. And Elijah, I want you to know that when Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord, I was hiding 100 of them. And I was feeding them bread and water to keep them alive. That took a degree of courage, it seems to me. It might have been a silent, quiet kind of courage. And yet at the same time, here was a man who was, how shall I say this? He was not so opposed and confrontational with Ahab and Jezebel. He was actually in charge of the house. So he was working within the system, whereas Elijah was working outside of the system and challenging and confronting the system. Two very different approaches. And yet the Lord used both of them to accomplish something. So it is a study in contrast. Obadiah seemed to be a very fearful person. And in most cases, Elijah is or turns out to be a very fearless person. One works within the system, the other outside of the system. Very different in their personality, very different in their approach to things. It's just remarkable. And as I have worked with our churches across the state, I have found, perhaps not to this degree, but pastors are different. They bring different gifts. They bring different vocabulary. They bring different emphases. And the Lord has a way of moving them around and of fitting them together in a way that is rather uncanny. It's illustrated, to a degree at least, that is this difference. It's illustrated in the New Testament, I think, of the Apostle Paul and Barnabas. You know something of their relationship and the breakdown in that relationship over John Mark. John Mark had gone with them on that first missionary journey, but for whatever reason, I don't know the inner workings, John Mark returned home. And so when it was time to go on a second missionary journey, Barnabas is saying, oh, let's take him again. And Barnabas is saying, no. Or Paul is saying, no, you know, he didn't stick it out with us, and we're not going to take him the second time. Difference between the two. as they debated it and struggled with one the other, the contention, I think that's the word the New Testament uses, the contention between them became so sharp that it ended up Paul went this way, taking Silas, and Barnabas went that way, taking John Mark, and the difference actually caused a split in that missionary team. And again, I don't pretend to know all the inner workings of that. But the truth of the matter is, Paul was a different kind of personality than was Barnabas. And it appears, just off the surface of things, it appears that Paul was willing to kind of take this young man and give him one chance, but don't you dare fail. And Barnabas was a little more willing to work with him and bring him along and maybe even make a little bit of an excuse for him. And then later on, they kind of got back together. But they were very different people. And I find this in the churches of our fellowship. I remember, and I want to come back to this business of fitting them. I remember when I left seminary, this is a long time ago, and began to search for the Lord's will for my life and our family, a pastoral ministry. And I landed ultimately in a church in Warren, Ohio. That was about the only hint I had that it was truly the right place. I was Pastor Warren in Warren, Ohio, and that was comforting. Beyond that, it was like, I don't think I fit here. This is not where I ought to be. And you may say, well, how in the world did you ever get there? And, you know, all of that, which is another whole story. But once I got there, it was kind of like, oh, I think I don't really belong here. This is going to sound crazy, but it is the truth. I had gone to Dallas Seminary, and I was 1,200 miles from home. Home was Detroit, Michigan. And we were so far away from Detroit, in another whole world in Dallas, that I never even felt homesick. But when I got to Warren, Ohio, I was just 200 miles from Detroit. And it was the fall of 1968. And the Detroit Tigers were playing the St. Louis Cardinals in the World Series. And I could hear every day in that fall, I could hear the great voice of the Great Lakes. Do you know what the great voice of the Great Lakes is? That's WJR Detroit. It used to be anyway. And I was a homesick kid. And I just thought, oh man, what am I doing here? Besides that, these people in this church, I just don't fit here. These are people who work in steel mills, if you know anything in Northeast Ohio. And I came from a commercial center in Dallas, Texas. And these people work crazy shifts. Some of them work day turn. Then the next week, they work afternoon turn. And then the next week, they work midnight turn. And then the fourth week in a row, they work what they called float turn. And that meant 2 days of days, 2 days of afternoons, and a day or so of midnight. And I want to tell you, by the time you run that kind of a schedule, you are floating. It was a very appropriate term for that fourth week. And I'm thinking, how am I ever going to have a deacon's meeting? How are we ever, you know, get all of this back together when they are doing all these crazy things? And I really thought, you know, I really missed it. This is crazy. But at the end of that pastorate, at the end of 8 years, and went on into teaching, as I look back on it and try to analyze what had happened, I realized that that church was exactly what I needed. Because they were very common, ordinary, working people. And that also made them very patient and rather gracious with this young upstart just coming out of school with all these high-flying ideas. But it also indicated that that group of people, not only did I need them, but they needed me and the kind of person that I was, both in terms of my ability to teach them and to bring them along, as well as to understand some in that congregation who had come out of a very poor and broken kind of family background, which I myself had experienced. So you just don't quite know, but you realize, okay, God has all kinds of people out there. And even though they are extremely different, the one from the other, God can use them to accomplish his purposes. And that's what you have going on here. The last little thought, and I've already indicated it, is simply this. God uses all kinds of people to accomplish his will. And the encouraging thing in that is simply, my friends, is that he can use you. Whatever may be your background, whatever may be your personality, whatever may be your level of education or your spiritual gift, there's no need to write yourself off and to say, you know, God can't use me in any significant or meaningful way. Yes, yes, you can. Yes, he can, and yes, he will. If Obadiah and Elijah had anything in common, and they did, it is what you and I also can share with them. What they had in common, it seems to me, was that they both feared and loved the Lord. And that is what made them useful to the Lord. And every one of us can fear and love the Lord and make ourselves available to him for whatever he has and trust him then to use us in his plan and for his glory. And that's why I chose the closing song that I chose, okay? It's number 379. I said it was a very individualized kind of a song. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. And then take my hands and let them move. Take my voice, etc. So you have this individual believer presenting himself, herself to the Lord and saying, here I am, and with whatever I've got, it's yours. Let it be consecrated to you. So we're going to sing verses 1, 2, and 3. It's 379. Stand with me, please, as we sing, Take My Life.